Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon, we are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which already stand to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is December 26th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for the first installment of Hitler's Declaration of War on the United States of America. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh.
Well, you know, I'd like to say a couple of things before we start, and that this is an answer to the very long procession of clowns that have comments to say about Adolf Hitler and World War II. And a lot of these people are otherwise patriotic Americans, right? And many of them have taken to the slanderous belief that Hitler was a Jew, that Hitler was a Rothschild agent, and this is all a damnable lie. The Jews had de facto control of Germany during the Weimar Republic. And they did not, and we see that in Wiebe, Germany and the Jewish Problem. We see it in the writing of Goebbels, and it's pretty evident to anybody that actually examines the period that is true. They don't need, during the Weimar Republic, the Jews don't need a Rothschild agent in order to do what they wished in Germany.
Because they were running the show.
Exactly. Hitler took that control away from them. And for this reason, the Jews plotted war against Germany since 1933. There was open talk of a future war against Japan and Germany in the Jewish press as early as 1938. And I'll get to that in a minute.
Well, how about Judea declares war on Germany, Daily Express, March 24, 1933. Jews of all the world unite in action. Boycott of German goods, mass demonstrations in many districts.
Well, that's the issue that doesn't exist, right? I mean,
well, if you go on the Daily Express and you try and get a archive issue, they have one available for the 23rd, and they show you a preview. They have one available for the 25th, and they show you a preview. It says the 24th is not available, and no preview is available. And when I emailed them and asked them, I said, I'm very interested in the 24th, and whatever the reasonable fee is, even if it's twice your normal fee of £50, I would like to buy that issue, and they never emailed me back.
No, because they're not selling it for the world. I have a facsimile of that on the Mein Kampf site.
I'd like the original, though, an actual issue.
Well, of course. Of course we would, because they're all claiming that the facsimile that many websites have, aside from mine, don't. I stole it from somebody else, or I borrowed it from somebody else.
They're claiming we invented it, and it's a fraud.
Right, it's a Photoshop, right?
Well, was it Photoshopped in the 60s when Patriots were referring to it then?
Well, the exactly. The it was Photoshop before Photoshop, just like Anne Frank was written in ballpoint pens before ballpoint pens, right? That the there's a Municher who contributes a lot to operating the Mein Kampf site at Christogenia. He Municher actually found this page from Life magazine that's dated October 31st, 1938, on page 11. Now, this is long before Hitler rolls tanks into Poland, right? And it says, America gets ready to fight Germany, Italy, and Japan. 3 years before the war. Over 3 years before America actually enters the war. They have their enemies all picked out. The only thing that explains that is that the Jews planned war all along against Germany, Italy, and Japan, and I'd like to get back to that in a minute also, but yeah, you know, in reality, the Jews set National Socialist Germany up for destruction because it stood in the way of the Jewish plan for world domination, a plan which is at least as old as the Talmud, expressed in the Communist Manifesto and the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that is that meaning the Jewish world, the Jewish hegemony over the world, is the de facto state of the world today, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's as old as creation.
Well, it absolutely is old as creation. But the only way that the Jews could affect their plan to destroy Germany is to get America and Britain to follow the Jewish Pied Piper into the destruction of their own Germanic brethren. And they did. Britain and America enlisted with Jewish bankers to destroy Kaiser's Germany in 1914. Britain and America turned their heads as the Jews destroyed Christian Russia from 1917 forward. Britain and America again signed up with the Soviet Union to destroy National Socialist Germany in 1939. Well, in 1941, technically, America joined that war, but it was in it long before 1941. And there's no doubt that the Jews, it's near common knowledge now that the Soviet conquest of Russia was an entirely Jewish endeavor, financed by New York and London bankers, and Britain and America unnecessarily held back their own forces to let the Soviets take Berlin, and then they turned over half of Europe to the Soviets after World War II. Britain and America turned a blind eye and even covertly assisted the communist takeover of China.
And most American patriots of the sort who style themselves patriots, rather, I should differentiate and say those who style themselves patriots would say we lost China and that it was unfortunate that Stalin gobbled up all of Eastern Europe and that he really duped us and he pulled one over on us. They don't want to admit, though, they can't reconcile the fact that they believe they fought a war for freedom, yet at the end of that war, half of the world was in chains by communists.
Absolutely. We sided with the devil. And the Rothschild, the bankers, the international bankers, and Bolshevism are basically on the same team. The Jews are the authors of both usury-based capitalism and of communism or Bolshevism. And they have played these two systems one against the other in order to entrap the entire world in global Talmudism, which is what we have now.
And if you look at it, World War I was billed as the war to keep the world safe for democracy, all that, the war to end all wars. Yet at the beginning of World War I, none of the world was under communism. At the end of World War I, the largest country in terms of area and probably the third largest in terms of population was under communism. Then in World War II, we have to keep the world safe for freedom and dictatorship. Yet at the end of World War II, 50% of the world's population and land area is now under communism.
Well, right. But all those world wars were pulled off by Jewish gimmickry. It's the same thing they pull in all of their marketing campaigns. They promise you the world, and when you buy the product, the end result is nothing like what you imagined it would be from the marketing literature. That's the way it is. The Jews have been pulling that same thing on us for 7,000 years.
The flimflam.
Those who disparage Hitler in Germany are in reality attempting to cover the crimes which Britain and America committed on behalf of the Jew. Adolf Hitler was eventually forced into a war against the Jew-dominated world. He had no choice. In this speech that we're about to present on Hitler's declaration of war against the United States, we're going to show his reasons, and that's why we're reading this speech.
And from what I've read of Hitler, he had no desire of ever being in a war with the United States. He had no intention of attacking us. And people say, oh, Hitler would have conquered the world. The Japanese would have conquered the world. And I'd say, what, the Japanese were going to conquer the world with their 500,000-man army and their lack of a strategic bomber? And I said, Germany didn't have a 4-engine bomber. They had 2-engine bombers and single-seat fighters. And you think they were going to conquer the world?
Well, absolutely. They had no long-range bombers. They had no fleet of aircraft carriers with which to project power beyond the shores of Europe.
Their army was entirely defensive.
Adolf Hitler always knew that he could not compete with Great Britain at sea.
And he didn't want to.
He didn't want to. He was forced to. Speaking about, we have in Life magazine that the Americans were definitely in The Jews were boasting in their own media that we were in this war. We were going to fight Germany, Italy, and Japan 3 years before the so-called surprise attack, right? That's just incredible that people don't see that. When you try to tell people that they're so programmed by the mainstream media that when you try to tell them that, they tell you you're crazy.
And I found some writings at the time, I think in 1942, by Jewish authors saying that we Jews, even if we are not with you physically in the trenches, firing rifles alongside you as comrades in arms, we are with you spiritually because you are fighting our war. That's what they said.
Well, I'd like to have that as, that might be good to document. Yeah, you know, Roosevelt was reelected in 1940. The chief of naval operations submitted a paper to the president known as Plan Dog. It recommended secret staff talks with the British and a Germany first strategy in the case of a two-ocean war. Yeah, you know, the military was reacting to the political climate, right? Being forced on them by the media.
I found that direct quote. It was from a French Jew in 1940. He said, even if we Jews are not bodily with you in the trenches, we are nevertheless morally with you. This is our war, and you are fighting it for us. And that came from Les Nouvelles Littéraires. I can't pronounce it. It's a French word. February 10, 1940. I'm going
to
put it up.
Well, that's okay. Maybe if you could email it to me or Skype it to me, I'll just post it, right, so people could read it. Early in 1941, American and British staff officers met secretly in Washington. The ABC1 conference accepted the Germany-first approach and agreed to create a permanent structure for Allied decision-making. In November 1941, the Americans revised Rainbow 5 into a two-ocean war plan with a Germany-first strategy and a defensive strategy in the Pacific until the fate of Germany was sealed. The Rainbow Five plans are war plans that were first developed against many different nations in 1916. They began developing these war plans, and they called them Rainbow Five. Well, it was eventually narrowed down to five plans, but they were named after different colors, and one of them meant, one color described a war in Mexico and Central America. Another color described a war in Europe against the English. Another color described a war in Europe against the Germans. Another color described a war with Japan. And these were eventually called the Rainbow Five plans. And what these plans, what they demonstrate to me, because they started formulating them in 1916, That doesn't prove that they were planning war against Germany and Japan in 1916, right? What that does is the Rainbow Five plans, I believe, show the climate in our government bureaucracy was built around an overseas imperialism that this nation was never designed to have.
That, certainly.
It, you know, it may have started with the Spanish-American War, and that was an unjust war also. But we became with the founding of the Federal Reserve and the transfer of all of our economy into the hands of the Jews, which is basically what that affected. We became a viciously imperialistic nation.
And we even had a war plan for a war with Canada.
Yes, we had a plan. One of the Rainbow Five plans was to invade Canada. Yes.
Was that war plan red? I think.
The United States planned on invading Canada in 1935. Now, these in the years building up to World War II, and knowing that the bureaucratic class in the media and a lot of the people in the military knowing somehow by magic, right, that we were going to get into war with Japan and Germany and Italy, the other rainbow plans fell to the wayside. And I have a copy on the Mein Kampf site of this Rainbow Five war plan. It's under the discussion menu, and the copy on my website I borrowed from iBiblio.org is actually the copy of the Rainbow Five plan. It was already revised. It was already made up and revised and presented on December 7th, 1941 to the Congress. In other words, remember the remember how the Patriot Act was already written. That this I don't know how many thousands of pages it was, but the Patriot Act was basically already written. And
it was waiting in the wings, just like the Communist Manifesto was written in advance of the revolutions of 1848.
Well, these Rainbow Five plans, they may have started to be formulated in 1916 as a result of our imperialism, but they were well developed and refined as plans distinctly detailing our course of action for a war with Germany and Japan, and plopped on a desk of Congress on December 7th, 1941.
And we had a war plan green to invade Mexico if their government should fall to rebels. The idea was that we would put a pro-American government in place. Well, why don't we do that now, since we really could use that now, since their government right now can't keep control of anything?
Yeah, you know, I think I heard a news bit somebody mentioned the other day about Italy. Italy banning illegal immigration.
Well, Italy's Supreme Court did declare in favor of a town in northern Italy. This town in northern Italy booted out all gypsies and said that no gypsies can come into the town because they're all crooks and thieves. And the gypsies sued, screaming discrimination. And the Italian Supreme Court said that it's not discrimination because gypsies really are all crooks and thieves.
Well, my point was, how could you ban illegal immigration if it's illegal in the first place?
Exactly.
That there was also a news bulletin last week that the a lot of the media companies in the United States are barring reporters from using the term illegal immigrant in their reports. Because our and the excuse that they're using is that the Constitution says that you're innocent until proven guilty. So we can't assume that any of these illegal immigrants are guilty, so we can't call them illegal immigrants.
Well, that's what Thomas Chittum said in 1995 in his book Civil War II. He said in the next decade, look for some nice term to come out, and he said they'll probably be called paperless workers or migrant workers or undocumented workers. He said that they would come out with some euphemism that would downplay the fact that they've flagrantly violated our immigration laws by coming here.
Well, right, and that's what they do. They've been calling them undocumented workers, but it's just an open plan, and people just refuse to see it. It's been an open plan all along. I mean, they're brazen enough to print in Life magazine that there's going to be a war with Germany and Japan and Italy that we're getting ready for, and then they want to consider Pearl Harbor a surprise attack.
Well, the British knew Pearl Harbor was coming.
And so did Franklin Roosevelt know Pearl Harbor was coming. That there really should be no doubt about it. The Lend-Lease Act, yeah, you know, the war really, I think the war really started with the Lend-Lease Act. That it started before that, right? And in December 1939, the British sunk a German ship called the Columbus. And it was a German passenger liner. And the USS Tuscaloosa was there to pick up the survivors. The Tuscaloosa was there to pick up the survivors.
And it just knew to be there.
This Tuscaloosa appeared many times in situations like this in the Atlantic, right? In December 14th, the German freighter Arauca departed Veracruz, Mexico, and was followed by the passenger liner Columbus, Germany's third largest ship, and two U.S. destroyers trailed it, the Columbus and the Arauca. And a succession of U.S. ships over the ensuing days were sending out plain language reports, position reports, on these German ships. Now, we're supposed to be neutral. Now, if the United States Navy knew where the ships were, why are they transmitting consistently plain language position reports? They were setting these ships up for the British.
Absolutely. In some cases, they actually forced these ships into British waters where the British could then seize them or sink them.
Right. This is one example. But this was going on for several years before the war. This is not a position of neutrality.
Absolutely not. And it's not a position of morality either. If you're the captain of the Tuscaloosa, that's a New Orleans-class heavy cruiser, a very well-armed American ship, and you see a small British destroyer heading to attack a passenger ship, an unarmed passenger ship, shouldn't you intervene and sink the destroyer?
Well, no, they were telling the destroyer, here they are, they're over here. Listen, right there, that's them. You're at war with them, aren't you? Get them.
I mean, you would think if the captain had an ounce of moral courage, he would have put his ship between the destroyer and the passenger ship and said that you have to get through us.
Well, right, and that's one of the things Hitler's going to talk about. There were many incidents like that that were clearly insidious on the part of the United States Navy. Because we were neutral, the German warship Araka shouldn't shoot at us, but we're broadcasting their location to the British so that they get shot at. It's really a precarious position.
If you want to claim to be neutral and you're going to help Al-Qaeda call in mortar strikes on U.S. soldiers, it doesn't matter if you want to claim to be neutral. A sniper's going to take you out, and rightly so.
Right, and the CIA would have you waterboarded. No. Right. You're not neutral at all, and that's what was going on, and it was going on for some time. And it built up to actual physical attacks on German ships before war was declared. I want to read something about now this is right from Wikipedia, but they're pretty honest about it, right? And the Lend-Lease Act was the name of the program under which the United States of America supplied the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, China, and France, and other allied nations with vast amounts of war material between 1941 and 1945. It was signed into law on March 11, 1941, over 18 months after the outbreak of the European War in September 39. But before the U.S. entrance in the war in December 41, it was called an act to further promote the defense of the United States. Now, which foreign powers were threatening? Nobody was threatening the United States at this time. The act also ended the pretense of neutrality of the United States. So we have Wikipedia admitting that it was the Lend-Lease Act which ended the United States' neutrality, which it did. But it also admits that neutrality was a pretense.
We declared ourselves neutral, and we wouldn't openly shoot at the Germans, yet we did everything short of that.
Well, in some cases, we actually shot at them. I think it's amazing that even Wikipedia admitted that the neutrality was a pretense itself. Hitler recognized this. He recognized that the pretense of the neutrality had ended with the Lend-Lease Act, and in response ordered German submarines to attack U.S. vessels such as the SS Robin Moore. There's no doubt that the Lend-Lease Act was an act of war. It was an act of joining the Allies in war against Germany. A total, just for information purposes, a total of $50 billion worth of supplies were shipped overseas, equivalent to $759 billion at 2008 prices.
Are you using the GDP?
Well, this is Wikipedia's figures, right? Yeah, it's probably a lot more than that, right? $31.4 billion to Britain, $11.3 billion to the Soviet Union, $3.2 billion to France, and $1.6 billion to China.
I calculated that it's 728 with the consumer price index, but if you use unskilled wage, it's 1.4 trillion, and if you use relative share of GDP, it's 5.5 trillion.
Well, that sounds more like it to me, just thinking about what a loaf of bread cost in 2008 and what a loaf of bread cost in 1938, right?
So if it hadn't been for Lend-Lease, the Soviet Union would have been destroyed, Britain would have had to come to terms with Germany, and that would have been the end of it.
Well, if it hadn't been for Lend-Lease, if it hadn't been for American perfidy, if it hadn't been that the United States and Britain were basically whores for the Jews, which is what we were in World War I and in World War II, if it hadn't been for the fact that we went and slaughtered our own kindred on behalf of the Jew, Germany would have fought the Soviet Union, and we would have today, we would have blondes from the Rhine to the Don. Germany would reach to the Don today.
And thinking about the naval war, by 1941, Britain had basically lost about 5 million gross tons to the U-boat war. I mean, there's really no way they could have made good on that had we not been turning out all those Liberty ships for them, so-called Liberty ships. We should have called them communist ships.
Oh, absolutely. That's what they do. They they call evil good and good evil, right?
And they call light darkness and darkness light. And if you think about it, the main rallying cry for America to go into World War I was the Lusitania, along with that so-called Zimmerman note that Germany was antagonizing Mexico to attack the United States. And, well, that's been debunked.
Well, that was a total forgery.
We have American ships sinking or helping in the sinking of German passenger liners. I mean, I wonder, did the New York Times report about that?
Well, I don't know. I would have to check it, but I would doubt it.
The Germans actually took out full-page ads weeks in advance warning Americans, do not travel on the Lusitania. We are going to sink it if it comes into our range.
Absolutely. That they did. They did that quite often.
And you were saying the Zimmerman note was an absolute fraud.
Yes, the Zimmerman note has been proven. That there was an extensive Barnes Review article on it. I'm pretty sure I read it some years ago, and it was proven an absolute fraud.
As far as notes to instigate a war, Hitler will deal with in his speech that the American president, Rosenfeld, actually sent a communication to Poland early in August, I believe, telling the Poles, do not negotiate with the Germans no matter what their demands are. Do not enter into an alliance with them. America will back you up no matter what happens. And even if they enter into your territory, in the end, the Western powers will drive them out. So Poland was basically told to adopt a hardline, ridiculous, no-compromise stance. Yet Germany was offering a full military alliance with Poland in exchange for Danzig, which was historically German. And in exchange, Poland would have had an ally right next to them to protect them from the Soviets.
And Hitler talks about Danzig in this speech.
I mean, obviously, Britain and France were in no position to defend Poland because they weren't anywhere near Poland. And it shows you the fact that they did not declare war on the Soviet Union. They weren't serious about defending Poland. They just wanted to use Poland at the, you know, as a sacrificial offering, basically, at the altar of internationalism to get the war going. Then when they didn't need the Poles anymore, they threw them over to Stalin.
Well, there's no doubt that the Jews wanted to subjugate Poland also. And that was a way to use Poland as an entry into the war and to legitimately lay a claim to Poland on the Bolshevik side, right?
The Poles basically ensured their own slavery.
Yes, they did. They ensured their own slavery. The Poles played into the hands of the Jews and the British just as much as the Germans did.
The Poles should have been allied with the Germans against the Soviets.
Well, they should have been if they cared about their freedom. But it goes back to these Slavic Saxon conflicts of the Middle Ages, right? I mean, it's never going to end. Not until Christ himself returns. The Slavs and the Germans will always be. Even Hitler hated the Slavs, and the Poles knew that, and they hated Hitler for it. Hitler hated the Austrians because they sold Austria out. The Habsburgs sold Austria out to the Slavs, right?
Oh, I wouldn't say he hated Austria or Austrians, but he definitely hated their government, their monarchy.
Well, right. Hitler, he just saw the Slavs as not as creative a race as the Saxons, and to a great extent, I mean, if you look at history and all of the inventions of history, that's pretty much true. The Slavs are basically a much simpler people historically.
That's not to denigrate them, but they're not as expensive.
No, it's not to denigrate them, but they just haven't achieved the level of inventiveness that the Germans have. They've, to their credit, they've had a lot more wars. They've had a lot more, a much greater struggle with Judaism and with the Mongols than the Germans have.
So they scarcely find time to settle down and get into a real culture since they're always fighting to survive and they're fighting to avoid being overrun by the hordes from the east.
Well, that's true. They had great fights against the Turks. They saved us from the Turks. I mean, the Serbs saved us from the Turks in the 1300s. They lost the battle at Kosovo, but it was so costly for the Turks that the Turks couldn't advance for another 200 years.
They basically had to dig their heels, and it was a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, yes, it was. But the Slavs, Hitler did denigrate the Slavs because of what he considered to be their backwardness.
And historically, right or wrong, Russia's always been viewed as backward, and we kind of got into that with the Third Rome, that it wasn't as backward as most people thought. But still, if you compared, say, Russia with the U.S. or Germany, it was backward to an extent.
Well, you know something. Russia wasn't as advanced as the U.S. or Germany, but Russia was an extremely advanced nation and very much industrialized nation in the 19th century. And we saw that in the Russia Number One report.
Absolutely.
And the descriptions of the factories that the Jews gutted. How could a backwards nation have all those factories in the first place?
Had it not been for World War One, or had the Russian people been as well-armed as the American people, there wouldn't have been Bolshevism. They needed World War One to weaken Russia to the point where the Bolsheviks could come in.
Well, I really believe that the ancient struggles between Slavs and Germans is what probably blinded the Poles to the fact that they would have had a much better shot at maintaining their freedom and their nationhood with Germany than they would have with the Soviets and with Britain. Yet, you know, what did Britain care about Poland? Britain was only set out to use Poland as a device to get Germany into World War.
Absolutely, and I think the British had a hand in the death of, what was it, General Sikorsky? Have you heard of him?
Well, there's a helicopter named after him, right? I'm not familiar with the details of the Sikorsky story, no.
Basically, he was no longer needed, and I think his name was Vladislav. I can't really pronounce it here. Vladislav Sikorsky. He died in 43 in North Africa, basically. His plane was taking off, I believe I want to say, from Alexandria. And shortly after takeoff, boom, it just plunged into the sea, and no one really knew. Oh, I'm sorry. He was taking off from Gibraltar. No one really knew exactly what happened. And it looks like some of the guards had been dismissed from the plane. No one was actually guarding it as they should have been. And Stalin hated the man and wanted him dead. This guy was basically the prime minister of the Polish government in exile. And he said that when the war was over, he was going to return to Poland and that there was going to be a Poland for the Polish people. And the Soviets weren't going to be there calling the shots. And Stalin obviously didn't like that. And by 43, the British no longer really needed the exiled Polish army and the Polish Air Force that they really needed in 40 and 41. So they needed to please the Soviets, and it looks like they sabotaged his aircraft. His plane just plunged right into the sea, and everyone died, except the pilot.
Didn't they get blamed for doing that to another Polish leader recently? Is that?
Well, it seems a lot of planes tend to fall out of the sky if the leader's unpopular with internationalists.
Exactly. Okay, I'm ready to get into this speech. Are you?
Sure. I've pretty much said everything I wanted to say, other than if you look at the German naval buildup prior to World War II, they always talk about the Bismarck and this and that, but Germany had one aircraft carrier, four battleships and battle cruisers, compared to the Royal Navy's 18 and America's 17. So it wasn't that impressive to me in terms of numbers. They only had 25 Z-boats or destroyers. So, I mean, really, were they? I'm sorry, maybe I meant to say E-boats and Z-boats. But really, were they looking for a war of aggression? If they were, they would have built it up a lot more, wouldn't they?
Well, Hitler wasn't even ready for a war of aggression on the continent, never mind at sea with Britain.
I think that they only had
a navy 20 times his size. No way.
Four panzer divisions when the war started. That doesn't seem like a man who's been preparing all this aggression.
I think Hitler had three divisions on the Eastern Front total when he pulled off the invasion of Poland. To Russia's, what, 100 divisions or something like that?
Well, I think Germany had about 800,000 personnel involved in the attack on Poland. The Polish army was split roughly 50-50 between the western border and the eastern border, and then the Soviets invaded eastern Poland with over 100-plus divisions.
Okay, I'd like to – this copy of the speech that I'm using is from the Institute for Historical Review. I'd like to read Mark Weber's introduction of it.
Certainly.
This was given by Hitler at the Reichstag on December 11, 1941. It has often been said that Hitler's greatest mistakes were his decisions to go to war against the Soviet Union and the United States. Whatever the truth may be, it's worth noting his own detailed justifications for these fateful decisions. On Thursday afternoon, December 11, 1941, 4 days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Hitler spoke to the Reichstag in Berlin. The 88-minute address, which he had written himself, was broadcast to the nation. In it, the German leader recounted the reasons for the outbreak of war in September 1939, explained why he decided to strike against the Soviet Union in June 1941, reviewed the dramatic course of the war thus far, and dealt at length with President Franklin Roosevelt's hostile policies toward Germany. Hitler detailed the increasingly belligerent actions of Roosevelt's government and then dramatically announced that Germany was now joining Japan in war against the United States. The day after it was delivered, an inaccurate and misleading translation of portions of the address appeared in the New York Times. Although this historic address should be of particular interest to Americans, a complete text has apparently never before been made available in English. This translation is my own, meaning Mark Weber's own translation, as are the brief clarifications given in brackets. Following the speech text is Germany's formal note to the U.S. government declaring war and a short list of items suggested for further reading.
Well, before we get into the meat, I would just like to add one more thing, too, that the United States had explicitly warned Japan against invading the Dutch East Indies, and they basically told them not to expand their war in China under threat of possible war with the United States, and they cut off all oil to Japan, a total oil embargo, and you know, Japan has no oil reserves, so that basically forced Japan into a situation where they either had to accept mediocrity and economic ruin, or they had to invade the Dutch East Indies and conquer oil. And of course they chose to invade the Dutch East Indies and conquer oil. But that just proves the U.S. was essentially backing Japan into a corner where Japan's only options were to have their economy implode or to go to war with the United States to get the oil they needed from the Dutch East Indies. So Rosenfeld made war possible. In fact, he didn't make war possible. He made peace impossible.
Well, yes, it was inevitable that Japan would have to attack the United States, that they were put into that position. And we helped industrialize Japan in the 19th century.
To use them against Russia.
Right. Well, the British and the Americans industrialized Japan, there's no doubt. Look at the names of the companies. Sony does mean Standard Oil of New York. It is an acronym for that. And NTT, Nippon Telephone and Telegraph, that's really like AT&T Japan is how that started out.
Now, are you sure that does mean Standard Oil of New York? Because I looked it up and it said it means Sonai Kobayashi Geisha.
Okay. They could say anything they want now, but that company was started with Rockefeller money, and a lot of those.
Well, I don't doubt it was started with Rockefeller money.
And I wouldn't doubt if they didn't purposely create an acronym that meant that worked both ways.
They like to hide in plain sight.
The RCA Victor, Japan Victor, most of those big Japanese corporations were originally British or American companies that started and building up Japan and industrializing Japan. Okay, Adolf Hitler. Deputies, men of the Reichstag. A year of world historical events is coming to an end. A year of great decisions is approaching. In this grave period, I speak to you, deputies of the Reichstag, as the representatives of the German nation. In addition, the entire German nation should also review what has happened and take note of the decisions required by the present and the future. After the repeated rejection of my peace proposal in 1940, by the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and the clique that supports and controls him, it was clear by the fall of that year that this war would have to be fought through to the end, contrary to all logic and necessity. What was the date of Dunkirk?
Dunkirk would have been in probably May or June of 1940.
That late, okay. You, my old party comrades, know that I have always detested half-hearted or weak decisions. If Providence has deemed that the German people are not to be spared this struggle, then I am thankful that she has entrusted me with the leadership in a historic conflict that will be decisive in determining the next 500 or 1,000 years, not only of our German history, but also of the history of Europe and even of the entire world.
Oh, and I looked that up. The Battle of France began on the 10th of May, 1940. By the 26th of May, the British and French had been smashed, and the British were surrounded at Dunkirk, and Dunkirk ended on the 4th of June.
Yeah, the rest of the World War didn't go like that. The German people and its soldiers work and fight today not only for themselves and their own age, but also for many generations to come. A historical task of unique dimensions has been entrusted to us by the Creator that we are now obliged to carry out. Hitler definitely wasn't a Jew, right? The Western Armistice, which was possible shortly after the conclusion of the conflict in Norway in June 1940, compelled the German leadership, first of all, to militarily secure the most important political, strategic, and economic areas that had been won. Consequently, the defense capabilities of the lands which were conquered at that time have changed.
And interestingly enough, in the case of Norway, Germany did not want to invade Norway, but they'd learned that the British were planning to invade Norway. They were going to mine all of the Norwegian harbors, and they were even considering invading into Sweden to shut down the iron ore processing facilities and all the rail lines. They were going to dynamite the rail bridges so Germany could not get any iron ore out of Sweden. So it just so happened that the day Germany decided to move into Norway, they headed off the British invasion, since the British were already on their way to start mining the harbors, and some German ships caught the British in the process of mining several harbors, and they sunk them. So that begs the question, what right does the Royal Navy have to lay mines in the harbors of a neutral third-party nation?
Well, absolutely. Hitler had to invade the Low Countries, and he had to invade the Scandinavian countries for strategic reasons. There could be no successful war against the British and French without holding those positions. And there's other reasons also why he invaded them. But that to me is foremost.
Once he secured Norway, though, he didn't go after Sweden and he didn't go after Finland because he wasn't the bloodthirsty tyrant the British want us to believe he was.
Well, absolutely. There was no point. He had Norway secure, and the British couldn't get to the other nations. From Kirkenes in northern Norway to the Spanish frontier stretches the most extensive belt of great defense installations and fortresses. Countless airfields have been built, and this is almost like a State of the Reich speech, right? Including some in the far north that were blasted out of granite. The number and strength of the protected submarine shelters that defend naval bases are such that they are practically impregnable from both the sea and the air. They are defended by more than 1,500 gun battery emplacements, which had to be surveyed, planned, and built. A network of roads and rail lines has been laid out so that the connections between the Spanish frontier and Petsamo in northern Norway can be defended independently from the sea. The installations built by the pioneer and construction battalions of the Navy, Army, and Air Force in cooperation with the TOT organization are not at all inferior to those of the West Wall, which is the wall along the German frontier with France. The work to further strengthen all this continues without pause. I am determined to make this European front impregnable against any enemy attack. And D-Day was very costly, right?
And you notice he's not saying that we're going to use this wall to hide behind, gather our strength,
well,
and invade Britain.
Not.
He's saying we're going to defend ourselves against attack.
It's the idea that Germany wanted to conquer the world is just Jewish propaganda to scare simple-minded Americans into running down to the enlistment office and signing up for the army to be cannon fodder for the kikes on Wall Street. There's no doubt.
And I had a teacher that said that Hitler declared in Mein Kampf that he was going to conquer the world and that he had a special hatred for America and Americans. He said that we were all mixed with blacks and Indians and we all had to be destroyed.
Well, your teacher is like a wind-up drone bot, right? I mean, wind him up and he says whatever the Jews want him to say. And that's most teachers in America. It's just like that.
But I wonder if she could give the page reference. Well, if she's gonna claim something's in Mein Kampf, she should cite the page.
This defensive work, which continued during the past, speaking about wind-up drone bots, we just got one. This defensive work, which continued during the past winter, was complemented by military offensives insofar as seasonal conditions were permitted. German naval forces above and below the waves continued their steady war of annihilation against the naval and merchant vessels of Britain and her subservient allies. Through reconnaissance flights and air attacks, the German Air Force helps to destroy enemy shipping and in countless retaliation air attacks to give the British a better idea of the reality of the so-called exciting war, which is the creation, above all, of the current Prime Minister, British Prime Minister, Churchill. During the past summer, Germany was supported in this struggle, above all, by her Italian ally. For many months, our ally Italy bore on its shoulders the main weight of a large part of British might. Only because of the enormous superiority in heavy tanks were the British able to bring about a temporary crisis in North Africa. But by March 24th of this year, a small combined force of German and Italian units under the command of General Rommel began a counterattack. Agadabia fell on April 2nd. Benghazi was reached on the 4th. Our combined forces entered Derna on the 8th. Tobruk was encircled on the 11th, and Bardia was occupied on April 12th. The achievement of the German Africa Corps is all the more outstanding because this field of battle is completely alien and unfamiliar to the Germans, climactically and otherwise. As once in Spain, 1936 to 1939, so now in North Africa, Germans and Italians stand together against the same enemy. So he's basically identifying the Jews, right? Not the British. While these daring actions were again securing the North African front with the blood of German and Italian soldiers, the threatening clouds of terrible danger were gathering over Europe. Compelled by bitter necessity, I decided in the fall of 1939 to at least try to create the prerequisite conditions for a general peace by eliminating the acute tension between Germany and Soviet Russia, meaning with the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact of August 23, 1939. This was psychologically difficult because of the basic attitude toward Bolshevism of the German people and, above all, of the National Socialist Party. Objectively, though, this was a simple matter because in all the countries that Britain said were threatened by us, and which were offered military alliances, Germany actually had only economic interests. I may remind you, deputies and men of the Reichstag, that throughout the spring and summer of 1939, Britain offered military alliances to a number of countries, claiming that Germany intended to invade and rob them of their freedom. World conquest, right? The Jew propaganda. However, the German Reich and its government could assure them with a clear conscience that these insinuations did not correspond to the truth in any way. Moreover, there was the sober military realization that in case of a war which might be forced upon the German nation by British diplomacy, the struggle could be fought on two fronts only with very great sacrifices. And after the Baltic states, Romania and so forth, were inclined to accept the British offers of military alliance, and thereby made clear that they also believed themselves to be threatened by Germany, it was not only the right but also the duty of the German Reich government to delineate limits of German interests between Germany and the USSR. All the same, the countries involved realized very quickly, which was unfortunate for the German Reich as well, that the best and strongest guarantee against the Soviet threat from the East was Germany. When those countries, on their own initiative, cut their ties with the German Reich and instead put their trust in promises of aid from a power, Britain, that in its proverbial egotism has for centuries never given help but has always demanded it, they were thereby lost. Even so, the fate of these countries aroused the strongest sympathy of the German people. The Winter War of the Finns, against the Soviet Union, 1939 to 1940, aroused in us a feeling of admiration mixed with bitterness. Admiration because, as a soldierly nation, we have a sympathetic heart for heroism and sacrifice, and bitterness because our concern for the enemy threat in the West and the danger in the East meant that we were in no position to help.
And interestingly, about that topic, when Hitler was explaining why he declared war on the Soviet Union, he said that the Soviet ambassador Molotov came to him with a number of demands, which the Germans either outright rejected or said that they would consider but would have to involve the third parties that were involved. The Soviets said that we want your green light approval to destroy Finland, and Hitler said why, and Molotov said because we believe Finland is getting ready to destroy the Soviet Union, and Hitler said to Molotov that that is so ridiculous I don't even know how to begin to address it, but we here in Germany cannot accept and will never accept that a small country such as Finland could ever pose an existential threat to the Soviet Union. That's what the Soviets were telling the Germans, that we need to destroy Finland before they destroy us. That's like a mouse saying that we have to kill the cat, you know, or the cat saying that I have to destroy the mouse before the mouse destroys me.
Right. When it became clear to us that Soviet Russia concluded that the German-Soviet delineation of political spheres of influence gave it the right to practically exterminate foreign nations, the relationship was maintained only for utilitarian reasons, contrary to reason and sentiment. He regrets that act with the Soviets, right?
I think he's talking, too, about what happened in Yugoslavia, isn't he? Since the Yugoslavian government was under a patriot, a nationalist, I forget the name of the king or the prince. Actually, I'm sorry, it was a king. And he was ready to side with the Germans and give them free military access through Yugoslavia and let the Italians and the Germans go through Yugoslavia to get to Greece, which was now under British occupation. The British were landing British and Commonwealth troops in Greece, yet the British, along with help from the Soviet Union, staged a coup in Yugoslavia. They had a pro-Soviet socialist prince overthrow the patriotic nationalist king, and then they put in power basically a pro-Soviet, pro-British puppet regime. And they immediately mobilized the army and said the Germans can never enter Yugoslavia, so it had to come to war.
That's what he's talking about in the paragraph above, where he stated that when those Baltic nations put their trust in the British instead of in the Germans, that they were lost.
And what happened to Yugoslavia after the war? What did the British do for it? Nothing. They sat by and watched as the Soviet Red Army overran the country.
Already in 1940, it became increasingly clear, from month to month, that the plans of the men in the Kremlin were aimed at the domination and thus the destruction of all of Europe. And history proved Hitler to be correct there, right? I have already told the nation of the buildup of Soviet-Russian military power in the East during a period when Germany had only a few divisions in the provinces bordering Soviet Russia. I think they were the three divisions I was talking about. Only a blind person could fail to see that a military buildup of unique world historical dimensions was being carried out, and this was not in order to protect something that was being threatened, but rather only to attack that which seemed incapable of defense. The quick conclusion of the campaign in the West, May to June 1940, meant that those in power in Moscow were not able to count on the immediate exhaustion of the German Reich. However, they did not change their plans at all, but only postponed the timing of their attack. The summer of 1941 seemed like the ideal moment to strike. A new Mongol invasion was ready to pour across Europe. Mr. Churchill also promised that there would be a change in the British war against Germany at this same time. In a cowardly way, he now tries to deny that during a secret meeting in the British House of Commons in 1940, he said that an important factor for the successful continuation and conclusion of this war would be the Soviet entry into the war, which would come during 1941 at the latest, and which would also make it possible for Britain to take the offensive.
And they did, in Africa primarily.
And what Hitler is doing is showing that Churchill knew ahead of time that the Soviets and the Russians would get into a fight, to the British advantage, right?
Well, I'm certainly.
Well,
I'm
they
almost
would take
certain
orders from the Rothschilds. I'm certain.
Absolutely, that the bankers in Wall Street knew what the Soviets were going to do because they were telling Stalin, "You're going to coordinate with Churchill and plan this war, and you better get into the war no later than the summer of '41."
Well, that's why Viktor Suvorov, in his book, he proves Hitler right, that the Soviets were about to invade all of Europe, and that Hitler struck to as a preemptive, right, as a preemptive move against that invasion. Otherwise, we would have an Irish Soviet Socialist Republic.
Well, you know, if somebody pumps a shotgun and they're getting ready to point it at you, wouldn't you be justified in quickly drawing your sidearm and stopping them before they can shoot you?
Right. But Suvorov subtitles his book Stalin's Grand Design to Start World War II. I don't believe it was Stalin's design at all. I believe that Suvorov, from his position, gives Stalin way too much credit. Stalin is just another puppet for the Rothschilds. Stalin on one hand and Churchill on the other hand, and because many Jews have physical deformities, Franklin Roosevelt on the third hand, right? Well, Stalin was as much a puppet for the Rothschilds as Churchill was. In my mind, there's no doubt. And they were both being manipulated into destroying Germany on behalf of the international bankers. And of course, if Hitler was a Rothschild agent all along, all of that would have been unnecessary, right?
They wouldn't have brought in an agent of their own who would then take away Germany from them so they could start a war and regain it.
Right,
they wouldn't
they
do
already
that.
Had it. They already had it. Why would they have to do that? I mean, they were happy to get America with peace, that they destroyed America with peace and took it over, right? The 50s, the 60s, the sexual revolution, women's lib. Well, Germany was already brought all of that 70 years before America was.
And if the 60s and 70s hadn't gone so well, we probably would have had a third world war that started in the early 80s, and it might still be going on.
Absolutely.
But had we not capitulated culturally, we would have been militarily invaded probably by the Chinese and the Soviets.
Exactly. Then we would have had a World War III. If this nation had stood up for its Christian principles, we would have fought that third world war. Yes, there's no doubt. Instead, we just rolled over and played the whore for the Jews.
And yet we pat ourselves on the back because the wall came down.
Well, today we pat ourselves on the back that the wall came down, and we sit and watch in front of our televisions and worship Jews and Negroes. So we've lost. And that war was unnecessary. The quick conclusion of the campaign in the West meant that those in power in Moscow were not able to count on the immediate exhaustion of the German Reich. However, they did not change their plans at all, but only postponed the timing of their attack. The summer of 1941 seemed like the ideal moment to strike. I already read this, right? A new Mongol invasion was ready to pour across Europe. Mr. Churchill also promised that there would be a change in the British war against Germany at this same time. In a cowardly way, he now tries to deny that during a secret meeting in the British House of Commons in 1940, he said that an important factor for the successful continuation and conclusion of this war would be the Soviet entry into the war, which would come during 1941 at the latest. That proves that Churchill was another Rothschild flunky, as Stalin was.
What wasn't his mother's name? Jerome? Surname
all
Jerome?
In advance. I'm not positive, right? It doesn't matter to me if he had Jewish blood or not. He was definitely a Jew between the ears. And which would also make it possible for Britain to take the offensive. Conscious of our duty, this past spring we observed the military buildup of a world power that seemed to have inexhaustible reserves of human and material resources. Dark clouds began to gather over Europe. What is Europe, my deputies? There is no geographical definition of our continent, but only an ethnic, national, volklic, and cultural one. The frontier of this continent is not the Ural Mountains, but rather the line that divides the Western outlook on life from that of the East. Let me say that and Adolf Hitler was fully conscious of this, to the Greeks and to the Romans, Germany was all the land north of the Danube,
as far as the Don. The Don is the ancient Tanais River. It's the river that comes straight down through, well pretty much straight down through
the Ukraine.
Modern Ukraine into into the Black Sea, right where the Cimmerian Bosphorus is, and the Sea of Azov, I believe, is that small sea above the Black Sea, right? I think I could be wrong. It's been a while since I've looked at a map. That's the ancient Tanais to the Greeks. That's the Don River. And that was what the Romans and the Greeks in later times, say around the 2nd, 3rd centuries A.D., that's what they saw as the division between the lands of the Scythians and the lands of the Sarmatians, that the Sarmatians dwelt along the Don, and that's where Scythia ended and Sarmatia began. And Tacitus described all of that land as German, from the Rhine all the way to the Black Sea, he described as German. He expressed doubt over whether three tribes were German, and those three tribes that he wasn't sure whether they were German or Sarmatian, and the three tribes were the Wends, who we know as Slavs in later history, right? The Finns and the Bastarne. The Bastarne would have lived right on the coast of the Black Sea, right near the Tanais, and between the Tanais and the Danube. Okay, that's my little aside, but in ancient times, all of that was considered Germania. That was all Germany. And Hitler was conscious of that. That's why he was always looking for Lebensraum towards the east, because he perceived that that land was originally German and that the Slavs had crowded into it to take it from the Germans.
And to an extent, they had.
Yes, and to an extent they had. He didn't realize, I don't think, how new the Germans were in that land, but he saw that land as all German and the Slavs as the encroachers, which is that the Germanic tribes were there first, there's no doubt. And the Finns and the Wends came later.
And probably at some point they were on the Russian steppes, weren't they? Before they were pushed west by the various Asiatic tribes.
Well, yes, they were all started on the Russian steppes. And the Saxons and the Cimmerians there were branches of the race in Europe before that time in Central Europe, but I don't think that any of them had ever really built anything that was a lasting culture until the Germanic peoples crossed into Europe. Okay. At one time, Europe was confined to the Greek Isles, which had been reached by Nordic tribes, and where the flame first burned that slowly but steadily enlightened humanity. And when these Greeks fought against the invasion of the Persian conquerors, this is Hitler now, they did not just defend their own small homeland, which was Greece, but also that concept that is now Europe. And then the spirit of Europe shifted from Hellas to Rome. Roman thought and Roman statecraft combined with Greek spirit and Greek culture, which is true. Roman culture is basically Greek culture retold in Latin, right? An empire was created, and the importance and creative power of which has never been matched, much less surpassed, even to this day. And when the Roman legions defended Italy in three terrible wars against the attack of Carthage from Africa, and finally battled to victory, in this case, as well, Rome fought not just for herself, but also for the Greco-Roman world that then encompassed Europe.
But Carthage was basically part of that, whether they knew it or not, since Carthaginian culture was Greco-Roman, essentially, wasn't it?
Carthaginian culture was Phoenician, and it was a cousin to Greek culture, but it wasn't quite the same, right?
And they actually did, they overtly worshipped Moloch, didn't they, in Carthage? They sacrificed children to Moloch. I remember reading that Hannibal's patron deity was Moloch.
The early Greeks even wrote about early Greeks sacrificing children. One of the most famous stories in Greece is the story of Agamemnon's sacrifice of his own daughter, Iphigenia, so that
to get the winds for the fleet,
so that
right?
He could have favorable winds to cross over to Troy, yes. So even the Greeks wrote about themselves sacrificing children, right? But yes, the Carthaginians, I mean, all of the Israelite tribes were accused of putting their children through the fires of Moloch, right? And that they took that with them across the Mediterranean. And if they didn't take it with them, if they didn't take those Hebrew, I hate to call them traditions, right? Habits, let's call them bad habits. If they didn't take those things with them across the Mediterranean, then we'd wonder about the history that we pretend to know, right? What we would wonder is if this identity story is true or not, right?
They were replicating all the sins of the Israelites.
Well, that's because they were Israelites.
Exactly.
That's
so
what
I wonder, do mainstream historians have any explanation for why the Carthaginians were worshiping Moloch, an Israelite pagan deity?
Well, you know, if you ask most modern academics today who the Carthaginians were, they probably tell you they were Africans, right? They probably try to tell you they were black. In spite of the fact that we have hundreds of accounts from Roman historians that they were blonde. Virgil wrote about blonde Phoenician Dido and how beautiful she is, right? He did call her blonde and her ivory white skin and how beautiful she was. Yes, that's in Virgil. That's in the first century BC Roman poet wrote that, right? So that not all Phoenicians may have been blonde, but if that was the ideal, then we see that the Phoenicians looked very much like us, right? There were actually a lot of Phoenicians in Greece. A lot of people don't know that. The Greeks of Thebes, the people of Thebes were really Phoenicians, and they were also described as being blonde by the tragic poets. In Aeschylus's play Seven Against Thebes and in Euripides's play Phoenician Women. The next invasion against the home soil of this new culture of humanity came from the wide expanses of the East. A horrific storm of cultureless hordes from the center of Asia poured deep into the heart of the European continent, burning, ravaging, and murdering as a true scourge of God. He's probably talking about Attila the Hun there, because Attila the Hun is said to have called himself the scourge of God, right?
And for some reason, he basically just stopped and turned around.
Yes,
after a conversation with the Pope.
He is calling himself, he is talking about Attila the Hun because he says next, on the Catalonian fields, Roman and Germanic men fought together for the first time in a decisive battle of tremendous importance for a culture that had begun with the Greeks, passed on to the Romans, and then encompassed the Germanic peoples.
That was the Battle of Chalons with the Visigoths and the Romans under Flavius Aetius. And had it not been for that battle, there wouldn't be a Europe, would there? I mean, had it not for that victory.
Well, you know, the Huns are all right. The Huns get a lot of bad propaganda, right? But a lot of that's Catholic propaganda. And it's not only Catholic, but it's also the propaganda of somebody called, of a man who was a Gothic historian. He was the first great Gothic historian, you know, written historian whose writings exist. And his name was Jordanes. And he was very anti-Hun. But Procopius wrote 100 years before Jordanes, and Procopius described the Huns as being tall and white.
Mm.
But without doubt. And Procopius was actually the secretary to the great Byzantine general Belisarius. They hired Huns as mercenaries in their wars, and Procopius would have known the Huns firsthand. The word Hun is a very, you know, it's a very general term that just basically came to mean the northern barbarians that came from the east.
Certainly. So it was a united effort, though, the Germans and the Romans, just like we saw with the Waffen SS. Hundreds of thousands of Europeans from all across Europe, be they Frenchmen, Dutchmen, Spaniards, some Portuguese, even some people who were doubtlessly not European, except geographically, some Albanians, a lot of Serbs, Ukrainians, Danes, they all joined the SS to go fight the Soviets.
Absolutely.
so that they recognized that the Soviet Union was the premier existential threat to all of European civilization.
Well, it was, and it's destroyed all of Eastern Europe.
Although I would guess,
to a great degree,
in the case of the Albanians, they just wanted to get a rifle and a pair of boots, and then most of them ran off back to their village.
They knew that Hitler knew that the Soviets would bring Mongol hordes with them. The Bolsheviks used Mongol hordes to destroy the Soviet, to destroy Russia.
Well, that's what he said in his speech explaining why he went to war with the Soviet Union. He said that Stalin was readying to renew the hordes of Genghis Khan and unleash basically a new wave of Tatar invasions against the West.
Well, that part's probably coming, I'm sure, but he's already mentioned Mongol hordes, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt. He knew what was going
to
happen.
He equated Stalin to as basically a modern Genghis Khan.
Europe had matured. The Occident arose from Hellas and Rome. And for many centuries, its defense was the task not only of the Romans, but above all of the Germanic peoples. What we call Europe is the geographic territory of the Occident, enlightened by Greek culture, inspired by the powerful heritage of the Roman Empire, its territory enlarged by Germanic colonization. Now that would include English in Hitler's mind, right? Which it should.
Yes.
Whether it was the German emperors fighting back invasions from the east on the Unstrut River or on the Lechfeld Plain or others pushing back Africa from Spain over a period of many years, it was always a struggle of a developing Europe against a profoundly alien outside world. Just as Rome once made her immortal contribution to the building and defense of the continent, so now have the Germanic peoples taken up the defense and protection of a family of nations which, although they may differ and diverge in their political structure and goals, nevertheless together constitute a racially and culturally unified and complementary whole. He's being a little liberal there, but that's okay. And from this Europe, there have not only been settlements in other parts of the world, but intellectual, spiritual, and cultural fertilization as well, a fact that anyone realizes who is willing to acknowledge the truth rather than deny it. Thus, it was not England that cultivated the continent, but rather Anglo-Saxon and Norman branches of the Germanic nation that moved from our continent to the British island and made it possible her development, which is certainly unique in history. In the same way, it was not America that discovered Europe, but the other way around, and all that which America did not get from Europe may seem worthy of admiration to a Jewified mixed race. But Europe regards that merely as symptomatic of decay in artistic and cultural life, the product of Jewish or Negroid blood mixture. We could stop this here and on that note, pick it up next week.
All right, and next week we'll see him outlining the specific reasons for why he felt Germany had no choice but to go to war with the United States. Since Germany made overtures for peace, they did everything possible to secure peace and secure agreements from the U.S., and the U.S. just would not hear of it. The U.S. didn't want to hear peace. Peace wasn't in their vocabulary. The only peace Rosenfeld would offer would be the peace of the grave.
I don't think Adolf Hitler put enough stock in how much the Jews had control over Britain and America. He really thought that he could make peace overtures based on the kinship of blood, which should be. That should be number one to a Christian. Hitler did think like a Christian and believed that ties based on kinship of blood were stronger than anything else.
But all Americans were hearing was, halt the Hun, halt the Hun.
Right. I don't think he understood how much control the Jews had over England and America, and how, even though he knew that they did have a good amount of it, but how much control their propaganda also had over the people of Britain and America.
Absolutely. And that so-called greatest generation that had been hardened by the Great Depression, I think rather they were just made bitter and they were willing to do anything for anybody so they wouldn't have to live like that anymore. And as soon as they went to war against their German cousins, the Depression ended and they were given everything they wanted. So it was basically a bargain with the devil. Wouldn't you agree that the Depression ending as soon as we went to war with Germany was no coincidence?
Well, no, it was no coincidence. And the fact that that all of this money suddenly appeared in the coffers of corporate America so that we could go to war with Germany suddenly appeared when we agreed to go to war with Germany. That is the proof alone that the entire Depression was a product
manufactured
of Jewish bankers. It was manufactured by the Jewish bankers.
And the Keynesians say that World War II got us out of the Depression because the government was out spending hundreds of billions of dollars and it put people in work. Well, no, the government was out putting people in work with money that the Jews finally made available to them because they agreed to go to war.
Exactly.
But the Jews didn't just hand us that money and say, here you go, we're sorry to hear you're in a soup line. That money came with a lot of strings attached.
No government can create jobs, right? No government's ever created jobs or created an economy. Governments are created by economies so that the people who built those economies can protect them.
But now the government could take money from you, from someone else, and they could go pay some teacher to brainwash your kids, and they'd say they created a job. But really all they did is they took a tenth of your income, a tenth of someone else's income, a tenth of someone else's, and so many people, and then they just gave it to somebody.
Absolutely.
All they can do is move money around and redistribute it.
Right. Government can create wealth.
So we will pick up then next week.
Praise Yahweh.
Yahweh bless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you next week.